I'm sorry, I've kind of lost my voice, and I'm getting it back. So I asked for a microphone, hopefully, so you could hear me. If it's too painful to listen to and you have to leave, I'm sorry. Hopefully not. We'll go ahead and get started on time. My name is Jenny Willis, and I'm going to be talking to you today about a topic that I just love talking about. We're going to talk about mammals of all different kinds that are living in and around Holden Village. Some of which I've seen in the village, some of which I've seen around the village, some of which I haven't seen, but I know are here. So we're going to talk about as many of them as we can fit into an hour. I have left off some of them that are more rare or more less likely for you guys to actually spot. Some of the things like martens and some of the smaller animals.
Saw a martin yesterday.
Did you? Darn it, I've included it. So maybe I'll see what I add to things for next week. But I've always enjoyed mammalogy. I teach at CSU. I don't teach mammalogy, I teach animal behavior. So I practice with companion animals, so dogs and cats are now what I spend most of my time working with as far as behavior. But before I got to be a professor at CSU, I was a park ranger for a number of years. And so working in the Park Service, I got to see, watch, and interpret behavior of animals for the public for a really long time. It was some of the most fun I've ever had. And so I love watching wildlife. I love helping people be safe while they're watching wildlife and hopefully not scare that wildlife away. And so we're going to talk kind of through different mammals and also some of the best ways to go looking for them and seeing them even if you don't see the actual animal. How can you tell if they were there? So since mule deer are kind of ever present around Holden Village, I decided to put these up here as a starting point. My sons found a baby fawn yesterday by itself in a little hollow. It was obviously where the mother had left it. And we left quickly because it's not a great idea to be around a fawn when mom comes back to find you there. So, but they're all around and they're wonderful. We're going to talk about them in a few minutes. So overall, we're going to kind of frame our discussion in terms of what problems are mammals trying to solve? What all animals, really, what problems are they trying to solve on a daily basis? And we tend to forget this since we no longer live in the wild, that most of what everything is about is finding food. We know where we're going to find food here, don't we? There we go. And we know food will be there every time we get there. I suppose unless we're really late. But it's always going to be there, and we don't have to spend lots of time contemplating it unless we're kitchen staff, and then they prepare it for us. But for animals, they spend 70 or more percent of their time trying to find food and then actually consuming it. Trying to outrun predators, or if your predator is trying to get your prey, everybody's got something that competes with them. And so we're going to explore some of the dynamics and the relationships of who eats what and who eats whom, and a lot of energy. It's kind of funny because when I was a park ranger and people would go, well, how can my walking towards an elk really really take away from their life experience? Like, if they run away from me, so what? And we forget, because we have an excess of food abundant to us, that if we have to do extra energy, it's exercise. But if they have to run away from things that shouldn't be, necessarily threatening them, wildlife expends energy, and so that does affect them. Temperature, how do they handle winter? This is a place that gets, if you look on the wall in the cafeteria, between 600 inches of snow each winter. It's not a very hospitable place, so how do animals handle that? How do mammals handle that? And how do they find companions, finding mates, finding members of their social group? We're going to kind of talk about that. So we're going to talk about some of the adaptations that each mammal has. And then we're going to talk about how can we find them. First, some of them are easy to find. The deer that wander through every day, the gold-mantled ground squirrels that try and eat your supper for you. So, you know, there are some of them that are easy and some of them that are hard. And so part of it is when you get to actually see the animal, but then a better part of kind of the nature detective in all of us can be finding them when they're not there, figuring out what they were doing just moments ago, what they were and what they ate. And we use that through signs. So we look at scat, yes, another nice word for poop. Look at scat to see what they were eating, what they were, how they're doing, what their diet is like. We look at tracks to see how long ago they were there and which direction were they going and was anything going with them. We look at browse. That's signs on plants of different animals. Sometimes they eat all the way down to the roots. Sometimes they just eat the new growth. It kind of depends on what animal it is. Sometimes we look at remains when we find a carcass. What might have eaten it? How much was left behind? How long has it been there? And how many different animals, how many different scavengers might have kind of come to take a look at it. Some of these things are going to be things that we revisit on my nature walk on Thursday. Because by Thursday, I'm going to have a great voice. I'm going to be ready to walk in places and look at things outside. Bedding areas. So sometimes you can find the grass, you know, kind of spread out and matted down where deer might have rested for the night. And homes. A lot of the smaller mammals, you can find their homes, you can find their holes, you can find their dens. So we can find signs of them even if we don't actually see them. And in fact, on many of my nature walks, we don't actually see the mammals, but we see a whole host of signs that they were there. So we're going to start with the cervids, the deer family that exist in this area. We have two. We have the mule deer and we have the elk. And here are two examples of males that are kind of in their prime. We're going to talk about antlers here in a second, but these antlers are kind of in the best condition they're going to be all year. So they've grown to their fullest extent, they've lost their velvet, and now they are kind of at their prime beauty. The main differences between mule deer and elk are size and coloration. I have yet to see an elk in and around Holden Village, but I know in Glacier Peak Wilderness they're supposed to be there, so I'm including them. Size-wise, we have mule deer at around 150 pounds, maybe a little bit bigger depending on the male. A female might be a little bit smaller. For elk, we have a dramatic increase in size. So cow elk are between 600 and 900 pounds, and bull elk might be 1,200 or more pounds. So they're very much bigger than deer. And I also want to call your attention to a couple other features that we'll see in some of the other pictures. But elk have an entire white or cream-colored rump, and mule deer just have sort of a white area around their tail. So if size is a little bit hard to judge from the perspective, like how far away are they, you can tell kind of by a dark neck on the elk and a large white rump. So looking at just mule deer, now just looking at them, I put a couple pictures in there that help you see why they got their name. They got their name because of their big ears, that they look like mules. And so here is a little fawn. When you see ears up like this, it's sort of an alarm. They can tell that you're there. They're looking at you. They're listening for something. Behavior-wise, with elk and deer, when you're watching them, we think of eye contact as a appropriate thing to do, but for them, that's what predators do. So when we stare directly at them, we like say the deer is right here, and I'm staring at the deer is going to feel kind of nervous. And they're going to show you that first by putting their ears up, and if you get too close, right before they run away, they'll pin their ears back, and then they'll run away. And so the way that you can do that is kind of turn your head to the side and look at them like this. And then they don't feel as scared. And you guys all laughed. It's true. If you do it and watch, you'll see what happens. Because then they go, oh, they didn't notice me. Okay, good. They haven't noticed me. Yes,
I know. I've had a mule deer on the 10 mile falls.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't didn't look really at him. And he went right up in the bushes and he stayed right there and I went right by his tail.
And I think that's so valuable because when you show that you're in control but you're not a threat to them, then they stay where they are. One of the most magical experiences I ever had was hiking a trail that was pretty far out of the way. And I was hiking alone one morning because I was on duty and I was hiking looking for people and making sure everything was okay. And this trail cut through and I look and the whole side of the mountain was covered with elk. The whole side of the mountain. There was nothing I could do to go around them. Except, like literally, I would hike a mile out of the way to go around them. And I thought, okay, well, I'm not supposed to approach wildlife. Okay. Rule number one, problem. Because they're everywhere. And so what I did was I looked down and I just kept walking. And it was so amazing to me that I could have touched them. They just kind of moved out of my way and moved back. And I walked through probably 200 solid yards of elk. And nothing really changed about their behavior. They just kind of let me pass. And I think that while you don't want to approach a mother and their, her fawn, if they're grazing and they're doing their thing and you just kind of want to observe them casually, just keep your face turned away. Because their vision really isn't very good, but they can tell when you're staring at them. Their three-dimensional vision isn't very good. So anyway, so we notice the difference between the top picture here and the bottom picture. What are we seeing? What's the difference? Antlers. Who has the antlers?
The males.
The males only. Males only have the antlers. In deer family, in the deer family, anything with antlers, only the males have them. The males grow them as an ornament, kind of to attract females. They do displays with them. It's sort of a sign of how healthy they are. Not necessarily how old they are, but how healthy they are. So if they're healthy, a 3 or 4 year old buck might have a better rack than a 6 or 7 year old buck who's kind of marginally getting by. They grow this, it's bone, each year, and they shed it each year. So that's basically like, well, for elk, it's actually as thick as your femur. For deer, it's a little bit smaller. But imagine growing that much extra bone and then getting rid of it each year. So these are females. Obviously, we've seen a lot more females in the village than males. I saw 2 males yesterday. All of them are in velvet right now. We're going to talk about what that is, but that helps them grow their antlers, giving them a blood supply. And then here, I want to call your attention to the fawn. And the fawn's coloration, both elk and deer have spotted fawns. Anybody think about why the spots might be helpful?
Camouflage.
It helps, any sort of spotting or striping helps break up the eye. And when you're looking for a picture of what you're trying to find, and you come up with kind of a, like when you think about animal vision, sometimes it's not as distinct as ours. So they can't tell an outline as much if it's spotted or striped.
I have a question.
Yeah.
With the growing of the antlers, now in humans you need calcium.
Right.
For bone. Mm-hmm. Where did they get that?
They get it from a number of places. A lot of plants do have calcium in them, but they also lick mud. So like areas that have sitting water, as the water evaporates, they'll condense the minerals around the edge, so they'll actually lick and eat a little bit of mud. So animals do unusual things to get some of the same things that we need. We need at the grocery store. I wanted to give you a chance to look at, because I've seen a number of tracks around, so that you can know a little bit more about the tracks that you're seeing. Kind of my rule of, is it deer or is it elk? Has to do with size. It also, the deer hooves look a lot like an upside down heart. So there's a point to them when they're not running. So like, if you look at this, it looks a lot like an upside down heart because the two portions of their hoof meet together in the middle. And when they're walking or when they're on stable surface, then you see this type of a track. I included this one in here because what that tells you is either one of two things. In that case, I actually think it is running for sure. When you see the toes split, it means they're putting a lot more force on their hooves. I've included a picture up on the upper right-hand corner of what their hooves actually look like. And so when they're walking, they're together, but when they really put a lot of force on it, they split the hoof, and it shows in their track. And I believe that this one here would be a good example of running. This one here, you can almost see the mud, see the crack marks in it. Sometimes it can mean an unstable surface, so their feet are just slipping down into it.
The pictures of deer tracks there, mm-hmm. Would those be of tracks of deer that were moving up?
Yes, they would be moving this way. So this would be direction of travel.
Okay, so it's that end that separates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and that's true. You can tell a number of things from tracks. You can tell direction of track or direction of travel. You can tell how fast were they moving. You can sometimes tell based on a number of other things when it happened, because of when the last time water happened, like say it was mud, but now the mud's dried, you could kind of have an idea of how long ago it might be. And sometimes you can tell male from female by size and by how the tracks hit each other. So like if the tracks, and you look and you have a whole string of tracks you can look at, you can see if the rear hooves hit just to the outside of the front hoof, then it would probably be a female because the hips are wider. But the males might be even or slightly inside the front as they go. So you can tell a lot about things just from tracks. I wanted to say a word about scat, because these are all deer scat. And it tells you about what they're eating and what time of year it might have been when you found this. This would probably be a spring scat for a deer or an elk. They look similar, just different with size, because it looks kind of like a cow patty. It's got they obviously had a lot of water in what they were eating, so it didn't form, you know, solidly because they had so much water in what they were eating. This is sort of an intermediate one where you can see that there are segments to it, but it was a little bit more formed. And then this is maybe what we're most familiar with late summer, fall, and winter, as the water kind of goes out of the plants. So putting a few pictures of elk in contrast, all of these are cow elk. None of them have antlers. I wanted to put a picture of a baby elk in so you could see it has spots too, because it's supposed to, like, because their mothers all leave them to be able to go eat, they're supposed to stay still in a spot. And so this, in theory, is what sunlight would look like coming through a forested area. So, like, little spots of sunlight. You can see the dark neck, again, as sort of a feature for identification, and the white rump. And again, these are much, much bigger animals. Tracking elk or comparing elk, I put a diagram in here of comparing deer, just sort of the upside down heart, with the elk, which is sort of the two parts of the hoof don't meet together exactly, and they're more rounded, so they don't have a point at the end. And then that's comparing it to a cow, an actual domestic cow. But here are some examples of elk prints in the snow and in the mud, and you can kind of see how they do look different because they don't have that sharp point in the front. Mountain goats are also supposed to be up here, and they are a little bit different. They are not in the deer family. They have horns, not antlers, and I put a couple pictures in here. When an animal has horns, both the males and females have them. They may have different sizes and varieties of them, but they both have them. And this is a baby. So this is a baby. His horns haven't grown much yet.
So what distinguishes between horns and antlers?
I'm glad you asked that. More slides and I'll have some diagrams for you. To go over really quickly, the differences in what, like for example, goat tracks would look like. You can see how the two parts of their hooves are much more narrow. So you can see that they actually have more narrow, not as big of a sort of bulbous area in the end. What's interesting about mountain goats and bighorn sheep is that they actually have a soft part underneath their hoof, and that helps them climb rock. So they actually do have some give to their hooves, and that's why they can spring from rock to rock and place to place. They have the same sort of differences in their scat from summer to winter. And I believe the next slide addresses your question. So I wanted to give you kind of what is the difference. For antlers, antlers are bone. And antlers are bone just like any bone in your body. They're grown from an area on the skull called a pedicel or pedicle. And they grow each year and they're shed each year. And they are covered in velvet, which is a skin with hair, a little bit of short hair. And the main reason the velvet is there is for blood supply. So if you look at an antler up close, which I don't have one to show you, you can feel where the blood vessels attach. So you can actually feel where they were, because they leave a mark, they leave an attachment mark on the antler. This is a deer antler here. This is an elk antler here. That's another way that you can tell them apart if you aren't sure. The deer antlers branch and fork, and the elk antlers all come off of one main branch, so the tines all come off one main branch. So essentially, when the deer antler is in velvet, they're very, very fragile. If they injure that antler, it may not grow. And you can actually see deer and elk who've injured the pedicle that have a deformed antler that grows each year because the pedicle itself was injured. So they have to be very careful. They also grow very fast. They can grow up to an inch a day. So they grow very fast, and that can become unwieldy very quickly for them to kind of have a sense of how big they are each day. Sort of like children, when they're growing, they kind of forget where they are and what they're doing sometimes. And it's kind of in the extreme with these guys that are growing these antlers. Elk antlers can weigh as much as 60 pounds. So it's a lot of weight on the head.
Is there a blood supply in the velvet?
Yes. The skin, the velvet is just the skin and the hair that cover the blood supply for the growing bone. And then about August, they'll start to, it's all governed by light changes. It's all governed by how long the day is in length. That changes the hormones that are released in the body. And so at the time when the light gets shorter, then they start to, the skin dies and they start to rub off the velvet. And then you see the mature antler that's ready for the breeding season or the rut, which is in the fall. Then they keep those antlers during the winter. And then again, it's governed by light changes and how short the day length actually is and when they actually shed them. So they usually shed them somewhere between January and March. And so they are antlerless for maybe 2 months, and then they start regrowing them again. So it's sometimes they shed them together, sometimes they shed them separately, and there's one on one day and one on the next day. But they shed them roughly about the same time. Horns are made of something that you have on your body too. Horns are made of a material like your fingernails. They're made of keratin. Horns grow over a bone, a tubercle that comes out, and the horn continues to grow. And it's a lifelong process of growth. So the horn actually continues to grow each year. Not maybe sometimes very much, but it continues to grow. So horns are are something that is not shed each year. If you see an animal that has an injury to a horn, they are going to bleed. It's going to be like ripping off a fingernail. It's going to be painful, and there's a blood supply that stays there. And sometimes you can see animals that have an odd or misshapen horn, and they may have had an injury, and it's grown oddly to kind of compensate for that. But both the sexes have them, so both males and females have them. As I said, it may be a different amount of growth or a different size of horn, but both males and females have horns. I wanted to look at the teeth as well of deer and elk. This is a deer skull here, a mule deer skull, and you can see that unlike some of the skulls we're going to look at a few slides from now, and even the teeth in your own mouth, a lot of them are kind of missing. They don't have any upper incisors. They do have some lower incisors, and they have a lot of premolars and molars. And they look kind of like that. This is an elk skull turned up so you can see its premolars and its molars. That would be kind of akin to your back cheek teeth. And you can see how sharp they look. And that tells you something pretty important about how they spend their time in the winter. They don't always get to eat green grass. They don't always get to eat nice, yummy leaves. They get to eat bark sometimes and parts of trees because that's what's available. And they have to have something sharp to grind them down. Now, what's different about elk than, say, our mule deer is you can see this tooth right there. They sometimes call them the canine or the elk ivory. And what it is a remnant tusk. And what's sort of interesting, this is, I think, the Chinese water deer, and you can see this sort of a tusk still existing. So back in history, that little tiny elk ivory was a tusk. And this is a picture of a beautiful, very wealthy Native American show of wealth, basically, of all these elk teeth, of the elk ivories used as decoration. So when the weather gets cold, the deer and the elk migrate away. They migrate to lower areas that they can paw at and still get grass and still get things to eat for the winter. They don't have a home that they can crawl into or a way that they can hibernate. So they choose the option of migrating when things get tough. Okay, so now we're going to talk about some of the predators. And first, can somebody tell me what's the role of a predator in an ecosystem? What does the predator do?
Thins the ranks.
What's that? What did you say?
Thins the ranks of the sick and weak.
Thins the ranks of the sick and weak. So they do a really important job. They keep the prey populations healthy. So they essentially remove those animals that are too weak to be able to continue and probably too weak or unable to reproduce and give good offspring for the next generation. So we have here at the top the mountain lion, also called the puma, also called the cougar, also called the ghost cat. There's a lot of names that this animal has, and we're unlikely to see it. We're likely to see its presence. We're likely to know it might be there, but they're very skittish of people. They hear and see us coming well before we see them, and they tend to be out of the way. So we might find their scat, we might find their tracks, we might find the remains of something they may have killed, but we are unlikely to see them. They also are sometimes above us. They may be in trees. They may be on higher ledges and higher places than we're used to looking for wildlife. We're going to talk a little bit about the coyote and his relative, the red fox. We did see a red fox in just over here behind Narnia yesterday. So red foxes are in around us, which tells me that we probably don't have many coyotes this close by, because they are definitely competitors, and you don't tend to see them in the exact same spots at the same time. And then we have the black bear. We're going to talk about the bears. I've seen bears very close to Olden Village. Not this year, but I did see one at the ball field last year. I know that they're around, and so we're going to talk a little bit about them. But predators, you know, for especially the younger set of the crowd, predators are not bad because they kill other animals. They do an important job for the ecosystem. So now we're going to look at some skulls, and we're going to compare the feline to the canine. We also have lynx in this area in Glacier Peak Wilderness. I would say we're probably even less likely to see a lynx than a cougar, but we may see signs of them. So we're going to use the cougar skull to kind of look at the archetype of cat skull, and the coyote skull to kind of look at the archetype of the canine skull. So what are some differences you see between these two skulls at the top? Anybody?
Longer jaw.
The longer jaw in the canine skull. Anything else? Yeah.
That it has more teeth?
Yeah, the canine skull has more teeth. That's really important,
that
yeah.
More teeth?
You have more teeth, that's good. The feline skull actually has the fewest number of teeth of any predator. So, and the reason is, their face is very short. Their jaw length is not very big. They don't have room for more teeth. But boy, they have good teeth when they have them. So you can see their big canines. Both of these animals rely on canine teeth for a reason. What do you think the role of canine teeth is? That's the big tooth there that kind of... they overlap and come up and down more than the other teeth. What do you think the role of a canine tooth is?
Catch the prey.
To catch the prey how?
By biting them.
Biting and holding on. It gives you some grab because other teeth might just kind of slide off. So these teeth, they sink in and they can really throw their weight behind those teeth. The jaw muscles are also really strong. If you look at, I can't point up there. This part of the skull, you can see there's like a bridge over on the top part of the skull where the bottom part of the skull fits, and there's all this extra room on both of these skulls. That room is where the jaw muscles come up from the bottom jaw and attach to the back of the skull. And you can see, at least on the canine skull, the angle's a little wrong on this one, you can see that there's a prominent occipital crest. And that's the point. The points of attachment are right before that for all the jaw muscles that they have to have. Now, if we go back a couple of slides, let's see if we can do that, and we look at that same part on the deer skull, there's a very small space. They don't need a lot of jaw strength. They don't have a whole bunch of jaw muscles that need to go through and attach. They have some, but they don't have to do the same job. So, canines and felines are similar in a couple of ways. They also have forward-facing eyes. That is something that we have too, and that's why we can give those cues to the prey animals, like, we're looking at you. You know, why do forward-facing eyes matter for predators? Anybody know?
Well, you have three dimensions.
Three-dimensional vision. When you are a deer or an elk, you have a small little amount of space right in front of you and right over your head of three-dimensional vision. All the rest is not three-dimensional vision. They actually have a bigger field of view than we do. They can see almost behind them because their eyes are on the side of their heads. So they can detect movement. So usually for a prey animal, you detect movement and you go, you know, do I need to run? Do I need to get out of the way? But for predators, you need to know how far away is it? Am I getting closer? Is it getting farther? You have to be able to judge distances differently. So forward-facing eyes are really important. And so you can always tell if it's a cat skull because of the shortened muzzle. Bobcat skulls, lynx skulls are all very similar but smaller, just keeping on getting smaller. And the coyote skulls are a version of the wolf skull would be bigger, the fox skull would be similar and smaller. Bears, let's see, we'd go back up a step. Cougars, lynxes, bobcats are all obligate carnivores. They have to eat meat. They don't have much other things in their diet. That's it. Coyotes occasionally will eat fruit. Occasionally will eat a berry or two, maybe some green browse or grass, but it's not a big part of their diet. With bears, they're truly omnivores, and if we look at their teeth, it's eerily like our own. They actually have a bear skull in the hike house. While they've kind of doctored it up a little bit with the antlers, which hopefully all of you will be able to go, I can get that fixed now. You can flip it over and look at their teeth. They look exactly like our teeth, like our cheek teeth. They're called bunyadot teeth. They're not sharp. Like if we go back and look at, you know, the cheek teeth of the coyote here, these are sharp teeth. You know, they're different than the elk, but they're sharp, meat-eating teeth. And they actually have a carnassial pair of teeth, two teeth that overlap each other. Maybe I can get at least the laser pointer part to work. Ah, I can. Right there is what the carnassial pair is. The carnassial pair are two teeth that cut like scissors through meat. And that's what their job is. And here you can see this tooth is part of the carnassial pair. It completely overlaps the tooth underneath so that they can cut through meat. Bears don't have that because they're omnivores. I picked some pictures here that kind of can help you look at what bears do. Black bears are, the last known sighting of a grizzly in Washington was in Glacier Peak Wilderness, but it was a while ago. So pretty much the bears we have are black bears. They're smaller, they're less ferociously aggressive, and they're generally better to deal with. They are omnivorous, and they are smaller than their cousins. So black bears are in the neighborhood of 600 pounds, whereas the grizzlies are twice that, if not a little bit more. And so they climb trees. Half the black bears I've ever seen have been sitting 30 feet up in a tree, and nobody sees them. They're just sitting there eating what they want to eat, doing their own thing, being good bears, not bothering people's trash, and you know, getting involved with us darn people. I also put some pictures in here that show you there's different color variations. And I couldn't find a great picture, but they can go all the way to like a honey color. It's really dependent on their own genetics. So black bear is not necessarily always black, but it's a size and a species term.
How common is a cinnamon color?
I don't think it's that common, but it's certainly present enough. I think it can be confusing in areas where the grizzly is also present. From a distance, it may be hard to judge what you're seeing, because the grizzlies can be a little bit lighter sometimes. But you can kind of see there's a lot of parental care that goes into raising bear cubs. It's, again, a good idea to avoid. It's a good idea to avoid bears. It's a good idea to avoid bears with cubs. And so they're also very good tree climbers. So when you backpack and you hike, if you go on an overnight hike, you might want to bear bag your food. And in general, what you want to do is go at least 10 feet up and at least 10 feet out on a branch so that it can't support a 600-pound bear to get out to your food. So they generally are not problems until we teach them to be problems. We can create bad habits by leaving trash around. Any animal worth its salt through the history of interaction with mankind will eventually come to our trash. And so we don't want to give them the option. So there's all these signs around Holden. You know, they don't say, help keep our bears safe. They can say, don't put your stuff here because bears will come. But really, if a bear becomes a problem, I don't know what the rules are in Washington State. But if a bear becomes a problem, most of the time it's a couple strikes and you're out. So they usually paintball them, remove them, relocate them. And if they come back and are a problem two more times, the third time they euthanize them. So that they just don't become a perpetual issue. Because bears, just like every other amount of wildlife, they would like to keep to themselves. They would like to do their own thing. They're attracted to us by our food. And I have seen the bears in Rocky and in Yellowstone walk right by someone's grill, eat something off. off the grill and keep going. And they don't really want to cause a problem to the people in the tent who aren't paying attention. They just want to eat your hot dog. So you just need to be vigilant about your food. But they are also omnivores. And that's what's interesting about bear scat. This bear scat up here in the top is mostly berries. And so late in the summer, bears are trying to, bears solve their problem of winter through not exactly hibernation. They go into winter torpor, so they do lower their body temperature and they do kind of fall asleep. It's not true hibernation. We'll talk about true hibernation here in another couple of slides. But they do have to have a lot of fat to get through the winter because they are planning to try and just lay there and handle, you know, getting up just a couple times in the winter. So here you can see in the skull that their teeth, they don't have a carnassial pair. Their teeth are actually fairly much like ours. And they do have a lot of fruit in their diet. And that's pretty important later in the summer. So if something happened and the fruit is not there, you know, if we had a late frost and it killed off a lot of the blossoms and the fruit and the flowers and the fruit subsequently didn't grow, it's those years we see bears come down into towns that they don't usually come into. So they keep coming down in elevation and keep trying to find what they need to find to be able to survive the winter. So these are bear tracks. Bear tracks are pretty distinct from the other tracks that we're going to look at in carnivores. You can see all five toes, so that's pretty important to think about as far as tracks. And you can see evidence of all five claws. So their claws are long, and they don't retract them. So you can see them in their paws, front paw and rear paw. And then here's sort of what that looks like in the sand. So you can see the indents of the claws. So if anyone gets to see bear tracks while you're here, let me know. Mountain lions. I didn't put any more pictures of mountain lions here because really, you're probably not going to see the actual animal. You're probably going to see their tracks, and their tracks are different. If you look at this track, what's different from the bear track? It may be around the same size.
Four-toed.
And no claws.
Four-toed and no claws because cats completely retract their claws. Just like your cats at home, their claws come out when they need them and retract when they don't need them. So they're not going to walk with their claws out. So if you see claws, it's never going to be a cat. You're going to see scat. And this is where every time I do a nature hike and we find scat, and I find a stick and I start poking at it, everybody goes, oh, no, we're looking at poop. But the cat, you can always tell it's cat. You pull it apart, look for hair. You're going to see lots of hair. And there's going to be a distinct cat odor about it that's going to smell kind of like a litter box. There's a cat odor about feces in the big cats and the little ones. So here's kind of showing you how big a cat track can be. So that's an adult man's hand. That's a pretty big track. Coyotes. They're some of my favorite animals because they're related to dogs and they're the best wild relative that I have near me that I can use to talk about dogs, which is what I usually talk about. So coyotes are interesting because depending on how well fed they are and what coat they're in, they can look a lot different. Coyotes range in size from, you know, a small of maybe 25 pounds to a large of almost 70 pounds. Depending on their location, the farther north you go, generally the bigger they are. But like for example, this guy here in a winter coat looks plush and big and fluffy and healthy. And you know, in part it's because he's in a winter coat. When he peels that winter coat off, he's going to look kind of scraggly like this guy at the bottom. And it's not necessarily that he's not fit. He's going to look skinnier because he doesn't have that extra coat. Here we've got a coyote track, and a fox track would be kind of in a smaller variety, but what's different about this track than, say, the cougar or the bear? What could we use to kind of differentiate it?
The number of toes.
Number of toes, so four toes. And you see claws. So we can kind of develop a rule. If we're seeing five toes, it's probably a bear. Five toes and claws, it's probably a bear. If we're seeing four toes and no claws, it's probably a version of cat, depending on the size. It might be lynx, might be bobcat, might be cougar. If we're seeing four toes with claws, we're seeing either a wolf, a coyote, a fox, or a dog. And a dog, oftentimes you can tell a domestic dog track from a wild animal because how long and overgrown its claws are in the track. So you can see it has extra big claws. But that's not, and there are a lot more nuances about tracks that I'm not sharing, like the angle of the toes and things like that. We just don't need to get into unless you really want to. But I'm trying to give you some idea of how you can see things in nature. So this is the red fox. And he is a very interesting animal. I put this picture up here at the top because when the cats and the dogs diverged, he was kind of on the first branch of the tree on the dog's side. He has actually a lot of feline characteristics. And I would like you to look at his eyes. Instead of the circular pupils of a dog, he actually has the slit pupils of a cat, which is one of his characteristics. This animal can semi-retract his claws, so he has some control over claws, which none of the other canines do. And I love this picture of him chasing this little small mammal. It looks like a vole to me, because it's very cat-like. They also, when they get afraid, they can do the Halloween cat pose. Arching the back and fluffing all of your fur up. So there's some behavioral characteristics, there's some physical characteristics that make them a little more cat-like. This is a little fox pup. The way that you could tell a fox from a coyote, if you look at the tip of their tail, the red foxes are going to have a white tip to their tail. Coyotes, let's see, do I have a good tail tip? Yeah, I do. Their tail tip's going to be black. So if you're not exactly sure, fox or coyote, that would be a good way to start telling. Other things about the fox, they are the size of about a house cat. A house cat with a really fluffy coat. So they may look a little bit beefier, but they really are only in the 12 to 15 pound range. They're not that big. And they tend to eat things that are small and easily caught. So. Voles, mice, all sorts of manner of small rabbits, things like that. Coyotes can get into bigger prey, depending on how social they are able to be. We talked a little bit yesterday about social groups. We won't get into much of that. Foxes are always pairs. Foxes always live in pairs with their offspring. And then their offspring grow up and disperse, and then they have the next year's offspring. So they're always in pairs. Their territories are very small, but they tend not to overlap with territories that coyotes have. Coyotes tend to view them as competitors and will kill them. So they kind of live around where coyotes are. So if you see red foxes, it's usually a good sign that coyotes aren't living there as their usual territory. Now, the great debate. What are those animals that are eating our food when we eat outside? And we have four species of chipmunks that are in Washington, in this area. The best way to identify a chipmunk, unfortunately, beyond saying it's a chipmunk, is usually by looking at its teeth. You don't get to do that most of the time. So even in all live mammal watching, a chipmunk is a chipmunk is a chipmunk. Because once we've identified it that far, we can't go further until we look at the lakes of dentine and its little teeth. So, this is actually a picture of a least chipmunk. And you can see the difference in all the chipmunks are that the stripes go across their eyes. So even if you didn't know how big they were, you were looking at a distance and you couldn't judge, the stripes going across their eyes are a chipmunk characteristic. Chipmunks are very much tinier. They're maybe a quarter the size of a gold-mantled brown squirrel. These are the guys that are living around here and eating our food. And gold-mantled ground squirrels have a little eye makeup, but they don't have any stripes. Their stripes are down their body. And these guys are very interesting. These are hibernators, so they go into true hibernation for the winter, which means that they have to eat enough of plants that have the right chemicals to help them produce what's called brown fat for them to be able to hibernate and come out of hibernation. And when they eat our cornbread or some other things that may not have what they need in it, we're not helping them. We're not helping them get that brown fat that they need. And they may very well go into hibernation and never wake up. Because when they go into hibernation, their body temperature is going down to 38 degrees. Their heart is only beating, you know, 3 or 4 times a minute. They're maybe breathing once a minute. They are not getting up to go to the bathroom. They're not generating any metabolic waste. They are just kind of on simmer. And they're they're keeping their body just warm enough so there's no tissue damage, you know, for cells to get too cold. They go down below the ground to where, hopefully, below where the freezing point is, so the ground is just cold. And they hopefully are around the same temperature as the ground. So they're insulated from the wind and the snow and everything up there that's much colder. And they're going to spend months this way. You know, they're going to spend, you know, probably from somewhere in October to somewhere in April or May, possibly as long as that. So they may spend a lot of time that way. So they have to be very fat. And at the end of summer, if you disturb them, marmots, them, any other of the hibernators, they're going to be these little chunky monkeys walking around. And if you get close to them, they're going to get irritable with you because they're going to have to move and they're going to have to waste that energy and all that fat that they're carrying around. So keep that in mind. These are golden-mantled ground squirrels. And as aggressive as they are, it's sometimes hard not to give them food because they come right up on your plate. But try your best to help teach them that they can't rely on us to make it through the winter. These are our tree squirrels that are in this area. This is the Douglas squirrel, and the red squirrel is from here north. I've seen this little guy. I saw this little guy on the way up to the mine the other day. So he has a very yellowy, kind of orangey belly and a dark body. And this guy, obviously for his name, he's much more red and with a white tummy. But they're going to be in and around the trees. So they're not going to have burrows as much as they might have little dens in the tree or tree nests.
Do they spend the winter in the tree then?
Yes, I believe they go into, they insulate themselves as well as they can. I'm not as familiar with the habits of those two squirrels because they don't live in my area, so I'm not as familiar with what they exactly do each winter. I can try and find out for you. I wanted to introduce you to a few things that you will not see probably while you're here, simply because of where they live. This is the Pacific mole, and he lives under the ground, and you can see some of his adaptations to his environment are very big paws for the size of his body. He is a digger. He's also got a great nose and a lot of little, what would essentially be whiskers to kind of help him feel, to kind of feel vibrations and feel for when he gets to insects and things like that. You don't notice very prominent eyes. He has eyes, but they're not extremely prominent because eyes are kind of irrelevant for him. Much of the time. So that's one little guy that we probably won't see. We might see evidence of, but probably won't see. And we also have the smallest mammal in North America living here as well, the pygmy shrew. And shrews are a very primitive mammal. You can see their teeth are kind of jagged and a little bit undifferentiated. And he's an insectivore, so he eats insects. And here's perspective of it, just how big he is. So he's smaller than a mouse. The only shrews I've ever seen have been crossing the road at night. I'll see something cross, and the shape is not right for a mouse, and it's much smaller than a mouse. You can see them. We have upper in the higher elevations, we have pika. These are an animal that is small, related to rabbits. Looks a lot like a hamster if you kind of take a look at this picture. He has a little tiny tail, but you can't really see it. And these are animals that collect food and are basically like the farmers. They keep their food in underground caverns, and they mix different types of leaves together so that they actually have like an antifungal, antibacterial effect. If they include an alpine avens in with the rest of their food, then it keeps nicely all winter. So they don't hibernate. They eat all winter, so they have to store their food.
So do we have them around
here? We have them here north at the higher elevation. So as you get close to sort of like a tundra, Krumholtz type area, you'll see them.
Because I've seen a burrowing animal that is definitely not a chipmunk.
Uh-huh. Where did you see it?
I saw it right up in the village.
Oh, really? I think, well, I'm not going to say no, because I don't know this area as well as I know the area that I come from. Okay. I won't say no. We are at a higher elevation for the Pacific Northwest, you know, than lower down. I think, you know, I would expect to see them more where I start to see tundra plants, you know, where I start to see different high elevation plants that they tend to like rocky areas. So they tend to make their burrows near where there's lots of rocks or talus slopes, kind of scree slopes. We have those around.
It was right by the rocky path.
See? And so I don't know. So maybe you can show me where that is and you can keep an eye out for it. Because really, I can tell you where wildlife should be. It doesn't always mean that's where they are. Mm-hmm. So every place is a little different and every animal is a little different.
Spell the name of this animal.
Pika, P-I-K-A. Sure. And these are marmots. These would also be a very high elevation animal. They are here, yellow-bellied marmots. And this is an example of what they look like underground when they're hibernating. These are some great hibernators. And this would be a late-season marmot with lots of belly fat. You can sort of see that. In the beginning, they start out, when they come right out, they look very lean, very skinny. And this would be a marmot hole, you know, kind of having him emerge from his hole early in the season.
They sound like prairie dogs.
They're a lot like groundhogs. Groundhogs and them are related. Mm-hmm. They're bigger than prairie dogs. Oh, yeah, that's true. They do.
Are they vegetarian?
Yes, they are. So they are also eaters of lots of plants, and they have to eat those right plants to be able to get that brown fat. Now, we don't have brown fat as humans except in babies. Babies are born with brown fat, but we don't have it as adults. Brown fat's very special fat that lets you thermoregulate, that lets you burn it quickly and get warm quickly. It's kind of like a fire starter, if you will, like making your little lint and wax fire starters. If you start to burn that fat, you instantly warm up. And that's why infants may have it, but we don't. And we have a few other year-round residents that stay above ground and keep eating and keep doing things. And they turn colors in the winter, and another adaptation to kind of existing in a snowy area where everything's white. You don't want to be the only brown thing. Excuse me. So this is the long-tailed weasel. There's a number of different varieties of mustelids that live here. Martins are another one.
Well, it was that. It was not. Martins are fatter, aren't they?
Martins are bigger. Yeah, yeah. Bigger and fatter, not
yeah,
as skinny. It was that guy,
yeah.
And I've seen the little guys too, the little ermines that are up by Heart Lake, much tinier, much tinier. And then the snowshoe hare, in all his color phases. And I wanted to show you kind of the intermediate phase too, because it's not an instant black, you know, or brown to white. They have to grow in a whole new coat. And so as that new coat grows in, they're mottled. They're not all one color. And then they get to be this beautiful white that you see in the bottom. And then they grow in their spring coat, and then it looks mottled again. And it kind of helps, because as the ground's patchy brown and white, so are they.
So is this one up in the corner here at the top right, is that, did you say an ermine?
That's the long-tailed weasel. They're both the same animal.
Oh, that's
a weasel. They're just the same. Yeah, they're the long-tailed weasel. And these are all the same animal too, just different color phases.
I've seen one of those. It looked like that up in the gargoyle pit.
Really?
Yeah.
And see, they're one that really should be helping us out with the gold-mantled ground squirrels, because that's, you know, the small voles and mice and chipmunks, and as big as a ground squirrel, they're very ferocious for their size. And their bodies are long shaped like that, so they can go down the same holes as the ground squirrels, so that they can go down and find them where they are. So that's why there's different species of them that are different sizes, but they're all shaped long like that. And that's one of their adaptations, their advantages. So with that, I want to respect your time and conclude on time. So I hope I've given you some insight into some of the other inhabitants of Holden Village and the surrounding area. And I'd be happy to stay and answer any questions for anybody who would like to go or needs to go. Thank you for coming.
I just wanted to say about probably 10 years ago, I was walking.